Case number 19-3042 et al. United States of America versus Lynell Tucker, appellant.
Good morning, counsel. Counsel for Mr. Fields, is it Rosenzweig,
your honor.
Rosenzweig. Good morning, Mr. Rosenzweig. Whenever you're ready, please proceed.
Good morning, your honor, and may it please the court. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. With those three words, Judge Maeda made it clear that he misunderstood the nature of Mr. Fields' claim to self-representation, denying that it had a constitutional dimension, considering it only a statutory claim. This was legal error, and legal error of this sort is, as the Supreme Court has told us, per se an abuse of discretion. Since representational claims of this nature are structural, they are not subject to harmless error review, and it follows a fortiori that this court should reverse the decision of Judge Maeda and remand this case for a new trial at which Mr. Fields may represent himself if he wishes.
There's a Sixth Amendment aspect to this, and there's a statutory aspect to this, but is there any authority for the proposition that under the Sixth Amendment, the right to self-represent is absolute when it's asserted in the middle of the trial?
No, Your Honor, there is not. Our contention, however, would be that it is essential that the judge addressing whether or not to conduct a balancing test in mid-trial understand that the nature of the right being asserted is constitutional, not statutory. It's no different, for example, than if this court were to fail to distinguish between a constitutional claim of due process and a simple APA claim of failure to follow an administrative procedure. Constitutional claims always get a greater weight.
Is there any reason to think, well, that might or might not be true, and there's a line of authority, there's a line of Sixth Amendment authority under Ferretta, and there's a line of authority under the statute. Is there any reason to think that for this kind of situation with the right asserted mid-trial, that the balancing test would come out differently under one than under the other?
We have no way of knowing that, Your Honor. We have no way of knowing how Judge Maeda would have resolved this case had he properly valued the right, had he properly understood that it was constitutional in nature. Indeed, he said, I am confused. I don't understand, he said, why they, the D.C. Circuit, that is you, characterize it as a constitutional right, because Daugherty doesn't say that. That, of course, is because Daugherty predated Ferretta by 3 years. And so he was relying on case law that predated the existence of this constitutional right. Our claim here is simply that without giving appropriate constitutional weight and value to the claim, he has committed per se legal error. And as the Supreme Court has told us, that is always an abuse of discretion, by definition, irrespective of whether or not the result might be the same had he done it the right way. We will never know that. We can't prove or contend about a counterfactual to any degree.
Why would we think the constitutional standard is stricter? Usually constitutional rights are a floor, right? They're the bare minimum of protection that a defendant gets, and Congress by statute or courts by rule can give a defendant greater rights.
Your Honor.
Why would we think that this statute gives the defendant less than he already would have had under the Sixth Amendment?
Well, two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that the statute predates the recognition of the constitutional right by the Supreme Court. And had the Supreme Court thought that to be the case, they would have in Ferretta said that the statute suffices, which they did not. And the second is that I know of no case, and perhaps counsel for the United States can identify one, I know of no case in which any court has ever said that the statutory right provided here is of greater moment, of greater significance, and a greater protection than that which was provided in the Constitution.
What about the speedy trial right? Isn't the constitutional speedy trial right a lot weaker for a defendant than the statutory speedy trial right?
That's true, Your Honor. This obviously there would be some cases in which Congress can magnify constitutional rights by statute. I would, for example, posit on the other side the differential between Miranda constitutional rights and the statutory Miranda case that was resolved in the Dickerson case many years ago, in which the court has pretty much said that the constitutional right exceeds or at least equals the statutory right. The question, of course, before us in this case is the nature of the right to self-representation.
Mr. Rosenzweig, do you agree if we disagree with you about Judge Mehta applying the correct legal standard here, then do you think it's an abuse of discretion standard under which we need to review this decision?
Well, I mean, it is clear that this circuit has never opined upon the standard to be applied to mid-trial assertions of a right to self-representation. The two cases that we've relied on before, both were dicta, Daugherty predating Feretta and Washington, involving not a claim of self-representation, but a claim of a right to present closing argument. So the court would be free, I think, to adopt whatever standard it wanted to. For my position, I would advocate for a standard that gave weight to the constitutional right and said that the burden was on the government and the court to overcome that right with some showing of need. So abuse of discretion would probably be your standard of review, but I would import within that a more significant standard of assessment earlier on. I see that I am running out of time, and I would be remiss if I did not, for at least a minute, turn to the Fourth Amendment issue that also is involved in this case. Imagine if a baseball player had hit a home run and then stood at home plate and said, I don't want to run, throw me another pitch, I want to take another swing at it. That would be nonsensical. Yet that is what the government would have you believe Officer Haskett did with respect to his traffic stop of Mr. Fields. Having already, they say, hit a home run, that is, observed a traffic violation that provided probable cause sufficient to stop Mr. Fields, he nonetheless waited and, as he said, maintained a vigil to see if the car would become mobile in an attempt to conduct a traffic stop for a traffic violation, that is to take a second swing at a second pitch and hit another home run. That makes no sense. The reality is, of course, that Officer Haskett had not observed a speeding violation, at least not one that he recalled immediately, and he was awaiting to see if there would be a drug transaction, as any reasonable officer might, or for the car to resume motion and to violate the traffic laws of Maryland. When neither of those things eventuated, he retrospectively realized that speeding had occurred and imposed that vision retrospectively on the reality he had seen before. But his own testimony to the fact that he was waiting for the car to resume motion is fundamentally inconsistent with that, and with respect, renders his testimony non-credible. For us, that means that Judge Mehta was clearly erroneous in his decision to credit that testimony, and with respect, ought to have discredited the testimony and not accepted it as a basis for finding probable cause to conduct the stop, and thus to suppress that evidence, which was the fruit, and the subsequent search of the barbershop, which was the fruits of the poisonous tree.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Rosenzweig, about that last point, the fruit of the poisonous tree argument? Do you know, was that argument made to the district court?
I believe it was, Your Honor.
Okay. If it wasn't, do you think?
I can't point you to it exactly in the record right now, but I believe it was in a post-hearing brief.
Okay, very good. If by any chance it was not made to the district court, do you think that means that it's been waived?
Yes, I would assume so, Your Honor. Yes.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve the balance of my time, if I may.
Do my colleagues have any other questions? All right. We'll hear from Ms. Schmidt now.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. My name is Amelia Schmidt. I'm representing Abdul Samuels. And today I'll be arguing the conflict of interest and ineffective assistance issues raised by Mr. Samuels. Mr. Samuels' trial counsel had a conflict. His daughter was applying for a position at the U.S. Attorney's Office while that lawyer was also representing Mr. Samuels. The lawyer never disclosed that to Mr. Samuels. He told it to the prosecutor. But he didn't tell Mr. Samuels, and he did not tell the trial court. And when the trial court found out about it, the trial court held that there was a conflict. So what comes next? And the Supreme Court says in Kyler versus Sullivan that if a lawyer was conflicted in the course of a criminal case, then there are two questions that have to be addressed. One, did the lawyer pull any punches? Was there a lapse in representation? And then two, was the lapse in representation actually caused by the conflict? And even if it wasn't caused by the conflict, then was the lapse still an effective assistance under Strickland? So we've established at least three lapses in representation, which I can talk about. But the question still remains, were those caused by the conflict or were those an effective assistance under Strickland? But either way, a hearing on remand is necessary to resolve these questions. So I'll start by talking about the failure, the counsel's failure to raise the issue of that Mr. Samuels had been using cocaine 30 minutes before he spoke to law enforcement. So Mr. Samuels, again, he'd been using cocaine. This was not disputed at trial. The prosecution actually talked about it twice in closing about how Mr. Samuels had been found by agents putting cocaine up his nose when the agents arrived at his girlfriend's house. 30 minutes later, Mr. Samuels talked to law enforcement. They asked him if they were going to find a gun upstairs. And Mr. Samuels said that there was a gun under the bed in his girlfriend's apartment for his protection. Mr. Samuels was charged and convicted of felony possession. And it was that statement, that was the only statement that convicted Mr. Samuels of the felony possession charge, because it was, again, it was his girlfriend's apartment. His girlfriend testified that the gun was hers, but the government played Mr. Samuels' interview in closing and said, listen, when he's pushed, he admits that there's a gun under the bed and that, and he says that it's for, that it's his for his protection. So
what's the argument that the lawyer should have made, that that statement was involuntary?
Yes, that it was, well, that it was not knowing or voluntary because he had been using cocaine 30 minutes prior to making it.
And what do you do with lots of cases? Colorado versus Connolly comes to mind, which stand for the proposition that if the statement is not the product of coercion by the police, there's not a constitutional problem with it.
Well, I believe it was, I mean, he had an obligation to at least raise it in a motion to suppress, given how important it was at trial. I mean, it's something that at least should have been litigated in a motion to suppress.
How could it have succeeded? What's the theory that statement was coercive because he was on drugs at the time?
I don't think it's that it was coerced. It was that it wasn't knowing or voluntary. Because he had been using cocaine, he was not in his right mind. And the trial counsel did say in his motion to suppress that Mr. Samuels had been suffering from heroin withdrawal. But the problem is that's, you know, again, I have a layperson's understanding of heroin withdrawal versus cocaine use, but they're not the same things. And again, just given how central this statement was to the government's case on the felony possession charge,
this isn't an in-court right that's subject to the knowing and voluntary waiver standard. I mean, the default rule is if the police approach someone and talk to him, they don't have to Mirandize someone outside of a custodial situation. And the person is free to speak or not, but it's fine for the police to ask the question.
We're not challenging the police asking the question. The issue is that the trial counsel didn't raise in his motion to suppress the fact that Mr. Samuels had been using cocaine. That's the issue. And I mean, we at least needed,
in order to do what? In order to keep the statement out on the theory that it was coerced, or in order to challenge the reliability of the statement?
To challenge the reliability of the state, I'm sorry.
It seems like neither one works. The coercion theory doesn't work for reasons that I said, and the reliability theory doesn't work because they found the gun. I mean, the statement was truthful.
Well, they found the gun, but the question was whether it was his. And he said, you know, he didn't say it was his in his statement. He said it was for his protection. And that's what the government, you know, the government characterized it in closing, though, as an admission that it was his. but it was the only piece of evidence the government had. And we don't even have a record of, you know, why counsel decided not to pursue that argument. We just don't have a record. And under the D.C. Circuit's case law on remand for ineffective assistance claims, if there's no record of whether or not counsel, pursued a strategic decision or why he didn't pursue it, that needs to be remanded to the district court to be litigated. So I realize I only have a little bit of time left, but I'd also like to talk just very briefly about the second error, which was the failure to investigate and timely challenge the government's expert on
Schmidt.
Yes.
Just before you go there, let me ask a kind of
we'll give you time.
Bigger picture.
Thank you.
It applies to all of the Kyler standard arguments. You know, in Strickland, when you do the first inquiry about performance, deficient performance, it has to be, you know, quite bad performance. It can't just be slightly worse than ideal. Do you read Kyler as not the Kyler inquiry about how a conflict affected the performance of an attorney to be a different inquiry than that? And if so, tell me how much does a potential conflict have to affect the performance of the attorney in order to satisfy Kyler? Is it enough for the potential conflict to have just affected the attorney's performance by 1%, just a teeny bit worse performance than the attorney would have done absent the potential conflict?
I think there were a few questions there, but I don't know that Kyler lays out a bright line test about how much it had to have affected the performance. I do think that under the DC circuits, you know, what case law we do have from the DC circuit about remanding conflict of interest claims, you know, the same notion that applies in the ineffective assistance context, I think applies in the conflict of interest context, which is that, you know, if there's a question of how much it did affect the deficiency or the lapse in representation, that's something that the trial court is best positioned to address because, you know, it oversaw the trial. It's the most familiar with the record in the case and with that lawyer's performance.
What about when go ahead, Judge. I'm finished with that.
I had a similar question. And you can think about it either in terms of the degree of deficiency, Strickland versus Kyler, or you might think of it in terms of how you prove causation, right? Strickland is a normal conventional causal chain, which is, did the deficient performance cause prejudice, harm the defendant on the bottom line? Kyler is different. It's this odd idea of linking the deficiency back to the conflict. And that seems like a hard thing for you to prove. So just to come back to the issue Judge Walker raised, which is how would you prove that a conflict of interest caused deficient performance if you look at the overall record and it seems like it's a relatively minor mistake in the context of a representation where the lawyer seemed to do a very good job overall?
Well, there are a couple of points there. I think in one on what you need to show, and what we would need to show, we don't have the record right now to show the causal link. We have some proffers from the government about certain dates in the hiring timeline, but we don't know, for example, when the trial counsel actually knew that his child was applying for employment. That's obviously an important fact that would have to be explored on remand. And, for the reasons we've laid out in our briefs, these errors, I think each were serious to rise to the level of either ineffective assistance under Strickland or a lapse in representation under Kyler. I think in terms of proving, a lapse, I don't read the two cases to say that, one has to be worse than the other under either standard. if that makes sense. I don't think Kyler and Strickland
parse it. I mean, it makes perfect sense, but it makes it a very hard case for you because deficient performance under Strickland is a tough burden to meet.
Well, deficient performance and causing prejudice, I mean, yes, I understand in Strickland, you know, it's a high burden, but if in the D.C. Circuit, all you have to do is show a colorable claim. You have to show a colorable claim of error and a colorable claim of prejudice. I mean, again, it's I think it's referred to as a standard practice in D.C. It's Rashad, Paul, Mohammed. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Your Honor.
No, I get the point. I get the point that if it's a close question, you win in this procedural posture, win in the sense of get a remand. But I think we're just trying to understand conceptually how Kyler works in a case like this.
Sure. And I realize there's not a lot of law in the DC Circuit on Kyler claims on remand. I mean, I know there's the McGill case where a defendant or the DC Circuit did remand on both conflict claims and ineffective assistance claims. And there's the Taylor case remanded a conflict claim applying, you know, again, what's a liberal ineffective assistance standard in the DC Circuit for remand.
Ms. Schmidt, though, but part of showing that there's a colorable claim in a Kyler type situation involves showing that there's some connection between the counsel's alleged conflict and the strategy that they pursued, right, or the mistakes. And I'm not sure that you've drawn out what that connection is in a colorable way.
Right. So one thing I do want to make sure is clear for the record. I mean, the trial court found there was a conflict, and I understand not even the government is challenging that on appeal. We're agreed there was a conflict. The question is,
what's the connection between that conflict?
Yes, exactly. But that's where, again, I think that's where a hearing is required. I mean, we just don't have the record at this point, and you know, we don't have the record at this point to be able to litigate that fully. And that's why Mr. Samuels is here asking for remand under, again, what's a pretty liberal standard in the DC Circuit.
What would you show other than the timeline of, you're saying one fact you need to know is what, when the lawyer knew about his daughter's progress with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
Correct. That's at least one, you know, important fact we would need to know. And our position here is, you know, that we've identified three errors, but yes, the question is the timing. Oh, go ahead.
So suppose let's take the most favorable assumption for you, which is that the lawyer knew about his daughter's situation before any of the lapses that you claim. What else would you try to probe? Like, let's spot you that one. Then what else? In a typical Strickland situation, you would ask the lawyer, why did you make this tactical judgment or that? Was there a reason why you withheld the argument? Is that the kind of inquiry you want? I mean, presumably the lawyer's never going to say, oh, I didn't make this argument because I was embarrassed for my daughter.
Well,
what you're probing is Strickland prejudice. I don't know how you probe, you know, Kyler causation. Did the conflict cause the lapse?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, a hearing, we are also asking for a hearing on Strickland and ineffective assistance, right? Because that is, the inquiry doesn't just end if you don't prove the causal link. But yes, to your honor.
Strickland works. Kyler is a little more odd.
Correct. It's odd. So actually the cases that the district court cited in its order finding a conflict lay out some things that could be explored in a hearing on remand. I think the Croken case talks about submitting, you know, even at minimum, written testimony from the child about, you know, their their process of applying, like what they recall about when the other lawyer found out, whether there are any discussions about the case. And then to your, you mentioned the obviously, yes, trial counsel, would be asked questions about whether or not the decision was strategic. But I think you would also want to ask questions about the relationship, discussions with the daughter about the case. I think those are just basic facts that should be explored on remand, and the cases the district court cited support that.
Okay. Any other questions from my colleagues?
Can I ask just one, Ms. Schmidt, what do I do if I don't think that there was a potential conflict?
So then you would, well, if you don't think that there was a potential conflict,
Right. I mean, you noted that the government in this case didn't go out of its way to strongly contest your position that there was a potential conflict. If I think that nevertheless there was no potential conflict here, what do I do with that?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one, that still leaves the Strickland question, right?
Right.
But to the point about the conflict, I mean, I think there wasn't a lot of case law out there on this issue. I think because the disclosure requirement is not onerous at all. It's pretty easily done. And the fact that this didn't happen here, I think was shocking to the trial court from the record. And then the trial court, ultimately found that yes, this was a conflict, and the cases that were out there supported that, as did, as we briefed below, the ethics opinions in DC also supported finding a conflict. But if Your Honor has specific questions about why you think there may not have been a potential conflict, I'm happy to address those.
Well, my question is more, assume that I don't think there was a potential conflict. I know you disagree with that. Does that affect this court's, should that affect my analysis, or should I say, look, the district court concluded that there was a potential conflict, the government doesn't contest that there was a potential conflict, it's appropriate for this court to therefore proceed on the assumption that there was a potential conflict?
Yes, I think that's appropriate for this.
And why do you think, tell me why you think that's appropriate?
Well, because it's a finding of the court. Of the district court.
Why is this court not in a position to disagree with that finding of the court?
Well,
or are we? Maybe we are.
I'm not sure. I don't think that this court should. I think there's a clear record below of why there was a conflict. And I mean, again, here, the disclosure requirements not onerous, and there's a right under the Sixth Amendment to conflict-free counsel that needs to be taken seriously. And when you have a situation where a lawyer's child is applying for a job, and it's clearly under our DC code of DC professional ethics rules, it's clearly a personal interest conflict.
The situation of an adult child living under a separate roof is imputed to the parent?
I think it's slightly different from the imputed. So the issue here about the conflict.
Maybe right, but what's popping in my head is, for purposes of financial disclosure rules, what stock my grown children have when they're on their own doesn't matter. I don't need to know about that. It's not a conflict for me.
Well, I think it can all depend. I mean, it's a very fact-based analysis. The relationship between the lawyer, what the case involves. I think there are different factors that can come into play. Here, the rule says that if the lawyer has an interest that would be adverse to his clients, he needs to disclose that. And, again, there isn't a ton of law out there, but to the extent there was, it's consistently been held that if a child, even an adult child, is applying and been hired by the office that's prosecuting your client in a criminal case, you need to disclose that to your client. And I mean, I know you mentioned the separate, you know, living under separate roofs. I think, you know, that goes to the question of the nature of the relationship, right? And those are the kinds of factual issues that would need to be explored on remand.
Those factual issues, though, seem to go to the question of whether there's a conflict, not necessarily to the question of whether there's a connection between the conflict and the representation.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I mean, you know, the district court didn't need to consider all those just to find under the ethics rules and the ethics opinions in D.C. and, you know, the court case law that's out there, Kogan and Chica from New Jersey, I believe that, you know, when you have a situation like this, where a child, even an adult child, is applying for and been hired by the office that is trying to put your client in prison, you need to disclose that to your client. So there is a conflict, but again, the question, so I do think they're separate analyses, but I'm happy to answer more questions about that.
Imagine this hypothetical, a partner at a law firm, there's a partner at a law firm whose parent is a justice on the Supreme Court. That law firm represents clients before the Supreme Court, although the partner at the law firm who has a parent on the Supreme Court does not participate in that litigation. Do you think that that law firm has a potential conflict of interest? Or do you think that the justice has a potential conflict of interest?
So I believe there's a different rule in D.C. on that than the one that we were discussing, than the one that was at issue below. I believe that is rule 1.8H, if I'm not mistaken, although I may need to double check that. But that's a different rule that governs situations when you have the situation you're describing, where you have a judge on one side and then the child is actually at the law firm. But that's not the rule.
I mean, you certainly, every client has a right to a judge that's not conflicted.
Yes.
Just stepping back and just kind of big picture, do you think that the judge has a conflict in that hypothetical?
I think the core analysis is the client has a right to know. I mean, conflicts can be waived, right? And that's the problem. That was the core of the problem that happened here, is that the client didn't know. The disclosure was never made. And so the client couldn't waive it. But I don't know if that answered your question, but that's...
Well, I mean, assume that the client represented by the law firm in my hypothetical was not informed about the parent-child relationship. Do you think that that there was something amiss in that hypothetical?
I would say it seems amiss, but again, I would say that is a different issue than the one that we were asked to brief before the district court, and that was before the district court.
Okay, very good.
Anything else, Judge Walker?
No, thanks, Judge Katsas.
Okay, we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Is it Lecker?
It's Lecar, Your Honor.
Mr. Lecar, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I intend to argue on behalf of the appellants, the joint issue of severance and transference, and then on behalf of Mr. Tucker, his sentencing issue, reserving 2 minutes for each of those two arguments for rebuttal. The trial judge, apropos the mid-trial severance motion, after Mr. Fields' testimony, with admirable restraint, said that he thought Mr. Fields, quote, might not have been truthful. My submission to you is that every word out of Mr. Fields' mouth, including A, and, and the, was perjurious. On top of that, his conduct in the courtroom was obstructionist. We've laid that out. What the jury heard, among other things, was Mr. Fields denying ledgers were his in his handwriting, denying text, but he understood text that he'd seen were in it. He didn't understand the meaning. He accused the prosecutors of a witch hunt. He said that the prosecution was trying to frame everybody, including his two friends, my client and Ms. Schmidt's client, because they couldn't find a case against another target, who he thought was the big fish. He accused the prosecutor of not understanding Black culture. in circumstances like this, and I'll grant you that severance motions that are successful on appeal are rare, but this is one of them. The transference effect is real and it's tangible. Let me talk about Mr. Tucker for just a second. He consisted of 2 minutes of a 70-minute opening statement by the prosecutor. He shows up on about 7% of the trial record, not even full pages, but just 7%. The evidence against Mr. Tucker was an equipoise. Yes, was he accused of having a license to sell drugs? He was on the scene, but nobody, aside from one sale, nobody ever said the text messages are not connected with any of his co-appellants. There's no audio of him talking with the co-appellants. There are a few videotapes of Mr. Tucker in the presence of Mr. Fields, but there's nothing to substantiate that they're transacting drugs under those circumstances. So what you had was, if I could submit, it's a Manny case. It's a Manny case in which you had a marginal co-defendant, and Ms. Schmidt's client as well, subsumed within an exceptionally perjurious obstructionist co-defendant, who, if I could borrow a phrase from one of the government's cases, the government cited a case called United States versus Piero, where the obstructionist defendant really was a sidelines cheerleader. My submission to you is that Jonathan Fields was the master of ceremonies and the host. The government seized on his testimony liberally, as they rightly should have, at closing argument and in rebuttal, and hammered home the fact that he had made these, that his testimony was replete with falsehoods. Under both circumstances, severance should have been granted because a reasonable jury could not have compartmentalized the evidence. It was overwhelming on this. The government's case against Mr. Fields was overwhelming. The connection to the defendants was somewhat tenuous. And in these circumstances, the curative instructions could not have saved the day and prevented my client from not receiving a fair trial. That's what happened in the Mardian case. That's what happened in the McRae case, which I will grant you, Fifth Circuit case, was not a conspiracy prosecution. But as the Fifth Circuit pointed out, it was tried as if it were a conspiracy prosecution, where you have the lead defendant engaging in what I would call in-court obstructionism and constant perjurious comments. It has to have a transference effect on the lesser defendant, particularly lesser defendants of a nature like this. I'll address the sentencing issue. As to Mr.
Before you do that, on severance.
Yes.
Those are all fair points, but one consideration cutting the other way is that this issue with Fields came up, day 11 or 12 of trial? And asking a lot to start from scratch when something happens, rather than try to mitigate the prejudice, give you free rein on closing to train your fire on Fields, give you cautionary and limiting instructions and such. Why isn't that at least a reasonable exercise of discretion in a pretty tough circumstance here?
I will concede to you it was a tough circumstance, but a curative instruction didn't save the day in McRae, and it didn't save the day in Manny, and it couldn't have here. Even free rein would not have saved the day, because the defendants, first of all, the prosecutor elicited from Fields, one of Fields' few truthful statements, that he had elicited from Fields that he was friends and grew up with the defendants. So, right, the prosecutor did that for legitimate reason. He wanted to draw up a connection. You would have difficulty as a jury compartmentalizing, and the courts do recognize that there are circumstances, this is one of them, where you have lesser defendants, far lesser defendants, whose case the prejudice to whose case cannot be resurrected by curative instructions or by giving counsel opportunity to argue. what are you going to argue there? The jury is going to saw with their own eyes that, for lack of a better term, you'll excuse the slang expression, the homie is sitting up there and just lying through his teeth constantly and then acting out in the courtroom. How is the jury going to compartmentalize? They might make the effort, but there's a subliminal transference effect. And that's what the court, that's what this court said in Mardian. You have to be careful for that. It's not, it happens. Mardian was a conspiracy trial and it was a successful severance appeal, notwithstanding the fact that they went ahead and tried the whole case. So the fact of the matter is they shouldn't have tried the whole case against Mardian. Well, they should have retried the case here insofar as Mr. Tucker and Mr. Samuels were concerned. Are there any other questions? I'm happy to answer on the seventh before I turn to the sentencing, but okay. In terms of sentencing, I want to be very to the point. What the law of sentencing tells us is we shouldn't make unreasonable extrapolations. And the district judge, who did an admirable job otherwise in the case, made a mistake. He made a mistake in methodology. And the mistake that he made was assuming from one sale of half a gram of heroin, that there were three sales a week made for three sales a week for 30 weeks at a conspiracy. I think that's empirically unfounded, that in government doesn't make decisions based on such.
Even though they know Tucker is regularly at the barbershop.
Well, let's talk about that. He is in the area. I'll grant you he's at the barbershop. Although how close is he to the barbershop? They place him going, coming downstairs one time with an equivocal gesture. What is Tucker selling? That's the key to this case. There's no audio of what he's selling. There's no text of what he's selling. The district, the judge, the government tries to claim that the district claims that the texts are more significant than they are. The district judge said, I can't figure out what those texts are all about. Clearly they're drug related activity, but what's the drug? There's no confession, unlike the government's cases. There's no seizures. There is nothing, literally nothing in the record to substantiate this extrapolation. And what the law teaches us from this court's decision to Stover, through Sepulveda, through Rivera-Maldonado, which are First Circuit cases cited in our brief, and Kilby, the courts have an obligation to be very careful in making extrapolations, because it causes, if you over extrapolate, if you make an unfounded assumption, it ratchets up a defendant's exposure dramatically. And that's what happened here. So I
sure. Mr. LaCar, I have a question that's similar to one of the questions I asked Ms. Schmidt. Assume I agree with you that the district judge made a mistake in sentencing, but assume that I think the mistake was that the district judge chose not to apply the career offender enhancement, which would have put the guidelines range between 210 months and 20 years. Your client got 5 years. Do you think that that issue is before this court?
That's a terrific question. The answer is, I think it is not. The government didn't cross appeal it and didn't claim it. They've waived it.
So I think there's some force to that conclusion. And I candidly admit, I probably lean a little bit toward that conclusion. But the counter argument to that would be that you did, through your appeal, put before this court the question of whether or not Mr. Tucker's sentence was a lawful sentence or not. And why does that not open the door to all questions regarding the appropriateness of Mr. Tucker's sentence?
I think the door is open to the extent that that the parties have briefed and addressed the issues that were raised as to the drug methodology and as the issue of harmless error. But the district judge's decision apropos of a career offender guideline and feeling that it and correctly concluding that it overstated the case, that wasn't appealed by the government. I mean, if you were going to take it up here unilaterally, that would have to be, you'd have to say that's an issue of law. But in fact, the district judge saw it in a different way. The district judge saw it as a question of fact and judicial discretion. It hasn't been briefed. if you were to now say, in this case, Judge Walker, that we've got, we're going to take a fresh look at it when it wasn't briefed on appeal, can you imagine what's going to happen in every other appeal that comes up before you where a party didn't brief an issue? They're going to say, well, look at that case. They got the right to get a second, government got to get a second bite at it.
Is the reason that we can't take it up that the government didn't cross appeal, or is the reason that it hasn't been briefed? Because if it's the reason that it hasn't been briefed, that's a problem that the court is now in a position to solve by just requesting supplemental briefing.
We didn't raise it in a brief. We didn't raise the issue of whether or not Mr. Fields was properly determined not to be a career offender. That wasn't part of our appeal. Our appeal was very narrow. Our appeal was this: the methodology was wrong, the extrapolation is incorrect. And the government's response was, well, the methodology is fine and it's harmless error. And that's what was briefed.
Very good. That's helpful.
I have no further, I reserve the balance of my time unless anybody has any questions, which I'm happy to respond to.
Judge Rao?
Yeah, thank you.
Great. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court, Dan Lenners for the United States. I'm happy to address the defendant's arguments in any order that would be helpful to the court and to any depth that the court would like. But unless the court wants to direct me to an argument, I'll just go in the same order.
Why don't we presumptively go roughly in the order that in which they were presented?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. The first argument the defendants raised was Fields' right to self-representation. I read the record differently than Mr. Rosenzweig. It does not appear to me that Judge Mehta misunderstood the scope of the defendant's right to represent himself when it first raises it during trial. When this issue first came up, Judge Mehta, who's an experienced judge, who is an experienced defense attorney, recognized that Fields did and did not have a Sixth Amendment right, that timeliness was an issue. That accurately describes the right of self-representation, which is sharply curtailed when a defendant first raises it after trial has begun. And in his balancing of the reasons, he was exercising his discretion not to allow Fields to begin to represent himself mid-trial. He once again recognized that he had to take into account Fields' rights, but balance them against all of the other considerations.
Yeah, Mr. Lenners, can I ask you a question about that balancing? Most of the cases talk about, you know, the right balanced against the prejudice to the defendant. You know, here the district judge also considered the prejudice to the co-defendants. And I'm wondering if that is a permissible consideration for the district judge to take into account. I mean, given that the Sixth Amendment right is an individual right, can we balance that right against the rights of other individuals? Is that a permissible type of balancing in this context?
I believe it is, Your Honor, because I believe it goes to the question of the disruption of the trial. Mm-hmm. That a defendant who's representing himself and who might be prejudicing his co-defendants by the questions he asks or the witnesses he calls is going to inherently disrupt the trial because the judge and everyone else is going to have to be on their toes to constantly stop lines of questioning, to interrupt answers, and to otherwise interject themselves into the process to make sure that this defendant Fields isn't prejudicing his co-defendant. So I do think it's part and parcel of disruption to the trial for the judge to weigh those two considerations.
And you think that's true only after the trial has begun? Do you think it would be permissible to balance that type of consideration before a trial has begun?
Before the trial has begun, a defendant does not have an absolute right to represent himself. The Supreme Court made clear in Feretta itself and in subsequent cases that even then the right is not absolute. But there, I think that severance would be a much more appropriate response to a defendant who wants to proceed pro se, as opposed to mid-trial when you're already a week into trial, have already had a week of evidence. That severance there is no longer as palatable a solution to this problem. So I do think that the judge, I'm not as familiar with Feretta and the cases that say what a court is supposed to look at pretrial. But it seems clear that once trial has begun, the judge has broad discretion to deny a defendant the right to start pro se mid-trial. And as we noted in our brief, I was unable to find a single case in which a court of appeals found that a district court abused its discretion by denying a mid-trial request for a defendant to proceed pro se. And the circumstances here certainly don't show an abuse of discretion, even if the judge misunderstood the nature of the right.
Yeah. So are there cases equating the scope of the statutory and the constitutional right in this situation when it's asserted mid-trial, or addressing one way or the other the question whether they would be the same or different?
Not that I've seen. As I said, Your Honor, I read Judge Mehta as saying,
I understand. You have that's your first line of argument. But
my second line of argument is in Doherty.
Another argument in your quiver, which seems plausible to me, is if everyone agrees that it's a qualified right, if asserted mid-trial, and the judge gets discretion to balance, what difference does it make whether you call it a statutory right or a Sixth Amendment right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe we made that argument as well. In Doherty, this court called the statutory right a fundamental right. It talked about its history as being one of the first things enacted by the first Congress. I think it was the day before the Sixth Amendment came up. And it talked about this history. And when the Supreme Court read this court's description of the statutory right in Feretta, it said it was intimating its constitutional nature. Ultimately, in Doherty, this court said, we don't have to decide whether it's constitutional because the statutory right is fundamental. And Judge Mehta read Doherty. He read Doherty into the record. So regardless of whether he had some misunderstanding of whether it was merely statutory or a Sixth Amendment right at the time he made his decision, he clearly understood that it was a fundamental right, that it was a weighty right, and that he had to balance that weighty right, regardless of its source, against against the disruption to the trial and the other factors that balance and go into the abuse of discretion standard. As to the Fourth Amendment stop, the defense has provided no basis for this court to second guess Judge Mehta's credibility finding after hearing the officers testify in person. This court, I'm not aware of any case in which it overruled a district court's credibility finding. In Delaney, it suggested that the testimony would have to be exceedingly improbable and either contradicted by empirical evidence, or there's such a clear contradiction between witness testimony that the district court would err by crediting one of them. None of those circumstances exist here. And thus there's no basis to reverse the court's credibility finding or its denial of Fields' motion to suppress. As for the Samuels conflict issue, I understand the Kyler standard to have three elements: a potential division of loyalties, a link or causal connection to an adverse effect on the attorney's representation. The focus of our argument.
So we're talking about the second and the third. Right. You haven't contested the first.
We have not contested for purposes of appeal the first. The second,
why not?
Your Honor, we made an internal judgment that we would argue as to the third issue, that even assuming that for purposes of this appeal that this was a conflict, that the adverse impact on Mr. Conte's representation that Samuels identified were not plausible alternative defense strategies. We did argue below that there was no conflict. that that she was briefed before Judge Mehta. He ruled against the government, and we have not proffered that here today as an alternative basis for this.
So you don't concede that there was a potential conflict, correct?
We don't concede that, Your Honor. And in fact, we think that were this court to remand to Judge Mehta and for him to order a new trial, that we might still be able to appeal that ruling, as it's kind of effectively interlocutory at this point. But we aren't.
No, please finish your sentence, sir.
I was just going to say we aren't today arguing it as an alternative basis for affirmance.
I think in my hypothetical about the law firm and the parent and the who's a judge, I think that there's no potential conflict there. And I don't think that that law firm has a duty to disclose to its clients that the child of a judge is a partner in the law firm. Do you agree with me about that?
Sitting here today, Your Honor, it's really hard for me. My instinct is to agree with you, but that instinct is not rooted anywhere in the law or in the code of professional ethics. I'm not an ethics expert. I'm not an expert in conflicts. I was very much focused in my research on this case.
Well, let me then shift to Kyler a little bit. Nickens seems to suggest that Kyler might not apply in all conflicts cases. Do you agree that it calls into question whether Kyler applies in all conflict cases?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's what Justice Scalia said, joined by four members of the court. They said that issue is not before the court today, and that was on the prejudice prong. They said, you know, whether Kyler's lower prejudice showing applies to all conflicts is not something the court decides today. They noted that the courts of appeals had unblinkingly applied it, but they didn't resolve that question because it wasn't before them at that time.
You haven't, just one quick thought on this, you haven't bracketed prejudice as element four for in this appeal. Right. You're arguing the deficient performance as related back to the conflict. You're not arguing that we should ignore, as you would in a Strickland case, that we should just ignore the deficient performance because it didn't cause any prejudice.
Well, I think our argument has been there can be no prejudice because there is no deficient performance. And that's why we didn't address prejudice separately. But we haven't argued, as Judge Walker suggested, that the court should follow Mickens' suggestion and treat the typical Strickland prejudice as applying to conflicts where there's no concurrent representation. That's what Mickens talked about. It said Kyler was multiple concurrent representation, prejudice inured to that situation, and it said courts had since applied that sort of minimal prejudice showing unblinkingly. We have not argued today that this is the case in which this court should take up that suggestion.
So focusing on lapse, what's your view on is lapse under Kyler the same thing as deficient performance under Strickland, or is it something less?
As I read the cases, it's something less, Your Honor.
How much less? I assume it's something more than just, you know, not being Clarence Darrow.
Yes, Your Honor. As I understand the standard, as it's been applied by virtually every other circuit, they've said, you know, we don't understand what actual lapse in representation or adversely affected performance for Kyler means, so we're going to try to define that. Mm-hmm. And virtually every circuit, as I understand it, has said the defense has to identify a plausible alternative defense strategy that the defense attorney did not follow. The Tenth Circuit has said a specific and seemingly valid or genuine alternative strategy or tactic that was available to defense counsel as the standard for lapse in representation or prejudice or whatever you want to call it. And so that's the standard we've applied in our brief to argue that the things that the defense identifies were not plausible alternative defense strategies. Some of them weren't even alternative defense strategies. For example, defense counsel did ask for a multiple conspiracy instruction. The district court had an independent duty to evaluate whether it should give that instruction when the defense had asked for it. They simply say the defense should have argued harder for it. That's not an alternative defense strategy. As for the link, I do want to be clear. We do not think that the defense has proven a link, but they have not had the opportunity to do that. Pursuant to an agreement that the parties entered before Mr. Samuels was sentenced, we agreed that the government agreed and stipulated that Mr. Samuels could proceed to sentencing and take this appeal without prejudice to his ability to raise the conflict issue later. My understanding is that pursuant to that agreement, we cannot argue and are not arguing on appeal. We're not faulting Samuels for failing to prove that link. If the court disagrees as to the effect on representation, we believe he's in.
So your only argument is no lapse?
On appeal, yes, Your Honor. I understand our stipulation below to preclude us.
So I have a concern about the stipulation, and it's just gone up substantially in light of what you said. We have cases that say, notwithstanding our normal excuse of preservation requirements in ineffective assistance for ineffective assistance claims, if the defendant gets a new counsel at trial and that counsel has an adequate opportunity to raise the ineffective assistance claim, whether it's Strickland or Kyler, there's a preservation obligation. And this business of you agree that you won't preserve something the way you're supposed to preserve something and then come here and ask us to give you a remand because there was by agreement, you know, you can't agree to change our preservation rules.
Your Honor, I'm aware of those cases. I'm aware of Your Honor's concurrence and Sitzman. I've briefed this issue multiple times.
It's a Durango. So
it's a pet issue of mine. I didn't see that being implicated here. Yeah, I didn't see that being implicated here. And let me explain why.
Okay.
The Judge Mehta appointed Ms. Schmidt and her partner as Mr. Samuels' counsel for sentencing purposes and to raise this conflict issue.
Right.
He said, please only brief the existence of a conflict. Mm-hmm. Do not address prejudice. So the parties only briefed the existence of the conflict. Judge Mehta then ruled against the government, said, I find a conflict. Now the parties need to brief prejudice. Mm-hmm. It's at that point that Samuels and the government agreed that he could proceed to sentencing without waiving his ability to show the requisite link and prejudice. And so we feel bound by that agreement not to argue a lack of link. If the court has independent concerns, I don't see a Durango problem, but maybe Your Honor does.
Well, why, if you have the new conflict-free counsel in place and the proceeding is still in the district court, I understand it was midstream, and as I understand it, there was some concern about not letting the briefing on the prejudice issue slow down the case, the other parts of the case. I get all that, but why couldn't the counsel have done what I thought counsel should have done in Sitzman, just on a post-trial motion, raise the issue on a post-trial motion?
They could have, and they did. Judge Mehta restricted their first post-trial motion to addressing only the existence of the conflict.
That was all post-sentencing?
No, it was pre-sentencing. The sentencing had been scheduled. Judge Mehta discovered the potential conflict. He appointed new counsel, Ms. Schmidt and her partner, and he ordered new counsel to brief only the existence of the conflict, not prejudice. He then found the existence of a conflict, and it was ready to have the parties address prejudice when the parties entered a stipulation to proceed to sentencing.
So why shouldn't we think of that as the parties trying to erase a preservation obligation that the defendant has under Durango? He could have pursued, I mean, what Ms. Schmidt's saying here quite forcefully is, look, all I want is a remand for fact finding. And that's a preferred thing in ineffective assistance cases where you have to develop the facts. I mean, you had that opportunity in the district court before the case came up here with the new counsel.
I agree, Your Honor. As I noted in the brief, this is an unusual procedural posture. I would have made a Durango argument except for our stipulation. I don't feel as the government, given that we agreed.
I respect your turning square corners once you have the stipulation. I'm questioning why you would have done that and whether the parties have authority to contract away preservation obligations and then come to us and say, please remand for a hearing that should have happened before the appeal was taken.
Sitting here today, Your Honor, I'm not able to answer that question.
Okay. I appreciate your candor.
As to the link, we do think that there are two ways the court can show a link. The court asked Ms. Schmidt quite a few questions about this. One is that there's such inherent tension between the attorney's duties of loyalty that there's necessarily causal connection. So when an attorney, for example, a defense attorney has also represented the witness or is concurrently representing the witness, the court has found sort of that inherent tension. There's no such inherent tension here. So then it's a because of. They have to show that Mr. Conti failed to take these actions because he wanted to advance his daughter's interests over Mr. Samuels.
Sorry, this goes to causation?
Yes, Your Honor. I was just trying to answer some of the questions.
I thought you said you don't feel able to assert that here and now, given the stipulation.
I'm sorry if I lost the court. I'm trying to discuss the legal standard, not the factual record at this point.
Oh, okay. This is just how Kyler works.
Yes, the court had quite a few questions for Ms. Schmidt about that, and I was trying to give my best answer.
We'll let you, with that in mind, go ahead.
So I think there are two ways to prove it. One is this inherent tension, which doesn't exist here, and the other is because of causation. At the remand hearing, were one to occur, Mr. Conti would have to say, yes, I didn't take these actions because I sought to advance my daughter's interests over Mr. Samuels. Or he would say, no, I didn't. And the court would discredit that testimony. And there are cases in which the courts have suggested that this sort of post hoc testimony is not particularly credible. Here, we think it would be credible, but that has yet to be determined. We focused our brief on the third issue, which is this plausible alternative defense strategy, which we don't think that Mr. Samuels has shown here. And thus, we think that his sentence can be affirmed without a remand. The judgment can be affirmed without a remand because the three things that Ms. Schmidt has identified as plausible alternative defense strategies, I know they're plausible nor alternative.
And tell me why the third of her three is the multiple conspiracy instruction.
Yes, Your Honor.
I hear you say that counsel did seek that instruction.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not recalling that. And the only concern, the only performance concern is not arguing it forcefully enough.
They say he should have pointed to specific evidence in the record that would have supported giving such an instruction. We don't think that evidence actually supports the giving of such an instruction.
Okay. It's coming back to me. That's the nugget about trying to expand the business or trying to sell drugs in Virginia.
Yes. They say, for example, counsel should have pointed to his post-conspiracy crack sales and crack possession as evidence that in favor of a multiple conspiracy instruction.
Why wouldn't that evidence tend to support the argument for a separate conspiracy instruction?
So as I understand the multiple conspiracy case law, it's that there has to be evidence that the jury could find this defendant guilty of a different conspiracy than the one charged. But the conspiracy charged ended on February 1st, 2018 with Field's arrest and was not charged to have involved crack. And so pointing to Samuel's post-conspiracy crack distribution doesn't in any way tend to show that he was involved in a different conspiracy pre-February 1st, 2018 to distribute the drugs charged. It's just completely separate conduct. And the judge recognized that and routinely gave limiting instructions for the purpose, limiting the purpose for which the jury could consider evidence of things that occurred after February 1st versus pre-February 1st, recognizing that that's when the charged conspiracy ended.
Is that because the later evidence is of planning to sell crack in Virginia in the future?
No, it was to prove that he possessed with the intent to distribute the crack found in his house on May 10th, 2018. So on May 10th, officers conducted a search warrant.
Right.
That's when they found the shotgun under Mr. Samuel's bed and 4.2 grams of crack next to the sink. He was charged with possession with intent to distribute that crack. And so the evidence post February 1st went to establish that charge.
But the crack was not part of the charged conspiracy?
No, Your Honor. Crack was not even charged as part of the conspiracy. The conspiracy was charged to involve heroin, fentanyl, synthetic marijuana, and maybe, Suboxone.
I see. So your theory is instruction or no instruction, the crack evidence wouldn't have tended to implicate him in the charged conspiracy.
Correct. And it didn't establish that he was involved in a different conspiracy than the one charged during the conspiracy period.
That's helpful.
If I'm happy to address Samuel's other plausible alternative defense strategies, but if the court has no questions, I'll turn to Mr. Tucker's arguments.
Okay, go ahead.
So Mr. Lacar argues that the judge abused his discretion by failing to sever the trial after Fields gave his testimony. The proof is in the pudding that the jury could and did separate the charges and the defendants. It acquitted Mr. Wright of narcotics conspiracy. It acquitted Fields himself of possessing the firearms that were found in the upstairs kitchen and the barbershop. And it found that Mr. Samuels and Mr. Tucker were not responsible for various drugs charged in the conspiracy. And it acquitted Mr. Samuels of the 924C possession of a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense crime. So it's clear on this record that the jury, in fact, followed its instructions and that those instructions suffice to cure any prejudice from Mr. Fields, obstreperous and untruthful testimony, but testimony that didn't actually implicate his co-defendants in any meaningful fashion.
That's a good fact for you. But if we look at this ex ante, and I understand it's a tough burden for the defendant, but boy, the contrast between Fields and the other two, both in terms of what they're actually doing, the degree of evidence against them, and the behavior at trial, seems pretty stark.
I have two answers, Your Honor. One, this court doesn't look at it ex ante. It has repeatedly used the fact of acquittals to support the district court's determination.
As one consideration among many.
Yes. Two, you know, Fields' testimony, the Supreme Court in Zafiro and this court following Zafiro has said severance is not necessary when one defendant points the finger at his co-defendant and says he's the one who did it. Fields didn't even go that far. He may have been difficult and he may have lied, but he lied about himself. His testimony touched on his co-defendants little, if at all. His counsel elicited that they were friends. He said they were good friends, and that's about the extent of it. And the evidence overwhelmingly established that. I mean, there were photos of all of them together at various points. There were photos on Samuel's phone of Fields.
Yeah, but didn't he say, I think it was Samuel's as opposed to Tucker, but as to one of them, he said that the person's presence in the drug log reflected auto insurance, right?
Yes, that's what he said.
If he's showing himself to be a serial perjurer, and then he gives that nugget, how do we think of that? Does that have any spillover prejudice for Samuels by sort of showing that they're all in cahoots to perjure as well as to sell the drugs?
Not spillover prejudice to such a great degree that the district court abused its discretion by not severing the cases. It gave the correct instructions that this court has approved of in McGill and Moore and other cases. And as I said, the proof is in the pudding that if Fields was a serial perjurer, he denied possession of the guns in the kitchen and the upstairs of the barbershop. The jury didn't hold that against him. It didn't say, oh, he must have been lying about that too. He must be responsible for the guns. And so I just don't think, and again, if a defendant saying it was his co-defendant who did it isn't enough to establish the necessity of severance, I don't see how the minimal amount feels.
When he says he didn't do it, that's not enough.
Yes, Your Honor. And then as to sentencing, the sentencing guidelines require the district court to estimate the amount of drugs involved. The district court does so under a preponderance of the evidence standard, and it comes to this court clothed as presumptively correct. And so nothing that Mr. Tucker has argued with regard to the district court's drug quantity calculation here is sufficient to establish that the district court clearly erred or to overcome that presumption of correctness. The evidence overwhelmingly established Tucker's involvement in heroin sales, his being at the barbershop constantly selling drugs as if he had a license to do so, and the completed sale to the confidential informant of 0.58 grams of heroin was a sufficient and factually correct basis for the district court to conduct the estimate that it was required to under the sentencing guidelines. And I would note the district court could have been wrong by 20% and still came to the same guideline calculation. The relevant band starts at 60 grams of heroin.
The 0.5 grams per sale is supported by the size of the sale to the confidential informant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there anything else?
Any other completed sales?
Any other evidence supporting that?
That's the only evidence supporting the amount involved in any particular sale, other than the fact that as the warrant affidavit shows, One time, the confidential informant went to the barbershop to attempt to buy heroin from Tucker. Mm-hmm. Tucker wasn't there. He was referred to Venable as Lonell's man, L's guy, and Venable sold him 1.1 grams of heroin. So that further supports the quantities involved in these street-level transactions.
And how about the 5 sales per week?
The court made what it called was a very conservative estimate based upon the amount of time that Tucker was outside the barbershop selling drugs. The evidence overwhelmingly supports that he was constantly there. This court has said that when courts do this sort of estimate, they have to be conservative. Mm-hmm. 1 sale a day, not even each day of the week, is a very conservative estimate, as shown by the quantities for which Venable and Clark were responsible. Clark was responsible for between 150 and 300 grams of heroin as a street-level dealer of heroin involved in the same conspiracy. Venable, I believe, pleaded guilty to 360 grams of heroin. And so the district court quite correctly engaged in a very conservative estimate to reach only 75 grams of heroin for Mr. Tucker.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Rao, anything else? Judge Walker?
No.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Leonard. Let's move on to rebuttal. Mr. Rosenzweig.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few very quick points in rebuttal. First, Judge Walker, to answer your question, ECF filing 69 was the motion to suppress out the barbershop evidence, and page 9, section 3B identifies the November 28th traffic stop as part of the grounds of the affidavit that was being challenged. To be fair, they did not say in hac verba, fruits of the poisonous tree, but I think that that filing was sufficient to preserve the issue if you get to reach that. Second point, also on the issue of the traffic stop, Mr. Learn said that there was a lack of empirical evidence to reject Officer Haskett's credibility. I would point the court to Government Exhibit 10 from that hearing. It's an overhead visual of the CVS parking lot where the stop occurred. And you will see that in order to traverse the distance from where he entered the parking lot to where he parked, Mr. Fields traveled no more than 150 yards and made 5 separate turns, making it empirically, I would think, doubtful that he could have sped through the parking lot at the speed that the officer suggested. A third point, turning back to the question of self-representation, and to answer your point, Judge Katsas, there are indeed a number of issues where statutory rights and constitutional rights are repetitive of each other. Off the top of my head, I can think of privacy provisions, self-incrimination provisions, and due process provisions where the statutory rights are, I would think, inferior. And to take Judge Walker's point, there are other statutory provisions which are superior, I think, to constitutional rights. We do not have any case law here suggesting that the statutory right relied upon by Judge Mehta was in fact superior to or more effective than the constitutional Faretta right. And the fact that no court has ever so held is suggestive, I think, of the fact that that is not the case. My final point on this would be simply that while Mr. Lerner's correctly refers to Judge Mehta's initial statement that was somewhat ambiguous as to his understanding of the constitutional nature of the self-representation right at issue here. I think that we have to take that in context and realize that that was the first thing that he said, and that after he went off the bench, took some time to study it, and came back, he came back with a far more definitive view. As I started this argument with, he point blank said, Mr. Fields does not have a Sixth Amendment right to self-representation, without ambiguity, without the he does and he doesn't that preceded that. And he then mischaracterized or characterized his understanding of Doherty as rejecting the constitutional nature of the right. That, we submit, is per se legal error and per se abuse of discretion, and thus, from our point of view, mandates a reversal and a remand for a new trial, at which Mr. Fields may choose to represent himself, and presumably Judge Mehta will manage that that problem as he did the severance problem. Thank you, Your Honor.
Questions from my colleagues? Okay, thank you, Mr. Rosenzweig. Ms. Schmidt, let me give you a shot at the question I had for the government, which I haven't given you a chance to answer yet, which is, if I thought that the new counsel had an obligation to preserve the ineffective assistance issue under Durango, what is it that lets the parties stipulate away our preservation law?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. So I am not the expert on Durango that Mr. Leonard has informed the court that he is. I will answer your question. But, you know, first of all, I would, you know, in addition to joining in Mr. Lacar's arguments that he's made as to severance, I mean, I also agree with the points that he's made about the fact that the government has waived these issues and that and the concerns that Mr. Lacar raised about proceeding on an issue that the government's already waived.
Yeah, that's fair. And that's normally the end of the matter if the upshot of the waiver is that the federal courts do less work than they otherwise might have, and we don't reach a forfeited issue. But here, you're asking us to do more work, which is remand for a hearing that should have happened before you took the appeal.
Well, and so I'll talk about that piece of it. So as I believe Mr. Lennertz noted, you know, my colleague and I were appointed after the trial on the eve of sentencing, which was when the district court found out about the conflict. I mean, my understanding is that the district court, you know, acted as quickly as it could. By the time that the district court found there was a conflict, you know, the parties convened, there was a status conference, there were conversations, you know, with the court between the government and defense counsel, and the district court was only willing to give 30 days to the parties to not just brief the issue, but I mean, to have a hearing, to prepare for a hearing and litigate it, which, you know, again, because, you know, we were new counsel. We were not trial counsel. This was a 3 or 4 week trial with thousands of pages of transcripts that would have taken 30 days was not an adequate time to investigate and prepare for that. And in the meantime, and also, I mean, the court did not disagree with that. The district court, though, expressed, and I believe this is laid out in the stipulation that the parties entered into, the district court felt that it could not give more than 30 days without materially prejudicing Mr. Samuel's rights on appeal. And in the midst of all that, the government had indicated.
Why is that?
Why is?
Why would taking whatever time was necessary to tie up the conflict issue materially prejudice? I mean, usually the district court ties up all loose ends as quickly as it can, and then there's an appeal. Nobody sought expedition, I don't think.
Sure. At that point, I believe the trial had happened in March or April of 2019. The other defendants had already been sentenced and were proceeding to appeal. Mr. Samuels and I had been sentenced, and I think this is also discussed in the transcript of the status conference. But I think to answer your question about, you know, why it would prejudice him, I mean, if Mr. Samuels took additional time to litigate this one issue, and then, you know, he would potentially prejudice his ability to litigate other issues that he might have raised on appeal, for example, severance issue that we're raising jointly.
Is that because his appeal would have happened too late to be consolidated with the other ones that were out in front of it?
Correct.
Okay, I got it.
Great. So there was that issue. And then on top of that, the government counsel had indicated to defense counsel that if we were to litigate it and Mr. Samuels were to prevail on this, you know, on what Kyler, you know, it's unclear from the record whether the district court would have expanded it to Strickland issues as well, but that also would have taken more time. But, you know, regardless, the government's counsel had indicated we will appeal this if we lose. And in the meantime, Mr. Samuels, who had not been sentenced, was, you know, was in jail. And I think this is also discussed in the stipulation. There was a detainer against Mr. Samuels in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So Mr. Samuels was potentially looking at spending a significantly longer amount of time incarcerated than he would if he otherwise proceeded to sentencing and then chose to litigate this on appeal. And I also want to note, just on a related note, so I think Mr. Leonard said that the court had ordered a briefing on prejudice. I think that's true, but the court's order also said, you know, we need to identify, but we haven't, you know, I haven't considered whether or not there were actual errors in the representation. So to do that again also would have involved some additional investigation and just time to litigate. And here on appeal, you know, we've identified three errors that we think did rise to the level of a lapse. And what we're asking for now is a remand to address the additional causation issue under Kyler and alternatively a prejudice issue under Strickland.
Any questions from my colleagues? Okay.
I had a few additional points on
quickly. You're well over.
Okay. Yes, understood. On the hypothetical, Your Honor, Judge Walker raised, I've gone back and looked at some of the rules. I believe the question really comes down to whether a reasonable client would want to know. I think I said that, but on the hypothetical of an attorney in a firm is at a firm that's litigating cases in front of a particular judge, I do think that would be a personal interest conflict as to the judge's child. It would not be imputed to the firm, but the judge's child would have to disclose it if there was a question of whether a reasonable client would want to know. So,
doesn't that cut pretty hard against you then? Because here, the prosecutor's daughter, sorry, the defense attorney's daughter was not the prosecutor on this case.
Well, again, here, no, the standard is, I mean, on a personal interest conflict, what matters is just she was applying for a job. And the rule says if a lawyer has a personal interest that would affect his ability to represent his client, he needs to disclose it to the client. And the standard is whether a reasonable client would want to know about that interest. And here, the district court found that based on the case law, based on the DC ethics opinions, yes, that's a conflict that a reasonable client would want to know about, and it should have been disclosed.
Okay.
So, okay. Thank you. And just a couple of quick additional points. I just wanted to talk briefly about this issue of Mickens versus Kyler. So I believe I understand Mr. Leonard's position and, you know, what the dissent has said about not applying the Kyler standard to cases like this or trying to limit the reach of Kyler. I think the precedent that is available in the DC Circuit cuts against that. I mean, I know that Kyler says, yes, if you're dealing with a case where there was dual or concurrent representation, that's a per se conflict. We're not arguing here that this was a per se conflict. We agree that Mr. Samuels needs to prove causation. And if you look at the DC Circuit cases that address conflict, I mean, they address and remand cases that don't just involve, you know, a dual or concurrent representation. The Taylor case, you know, involved a remand where it appeared that the client potentially had an advice of counsel defense at the trial that he could have used. And instead that same counsel advised him to plead guilty. And so the district court remanded it. So I think I would not read Kyler as narrowly as the government is arguing. And I think the DC Circuit precedent supports that. And then
give you one.
Go ahead.
Take your best shot of what you have left.
Yes. And on the multiple conspiracies argument, I would say, I do want to clarify a couple of things because I think the government mischaracterizes the record on some important points. So it's not just that Mr. Connie failed to sufficiently argue it. It's that the district court directly asked him a question or made a comment that said, He said, I'm going to give this multiple conspiracy instruction to Mr. Tucker because I think the evidence is there because there's evidence that he was interacting with unidentified individuals outside the conspiracy. And I don't see that evidence. The court was saying, I don't see that evidence here for your client, Mr. Connie. And Mr. Samuel's lawyer said, well, that's correct, but that was not correct. It was a misrepresentation of the evidence. I mean, there was a text and a text from, you know, within the charged conspiracy period that the government's talking about from 2017, where the government pointed to it, had it introduced at trial, where it said, Mr. Samuels texted an unidentified individual and said, the guy I will go through will give 3.0 for 150. So let your client know that. Again, that was within the period of the charged conspiracy. And second, on the testimony from Mr. Clark,
what do you say to the government's position that wouldn't have been within the conspiracy anyway, because it's a different drug?
Well, I mean, the problem was that it led to juror confusion. I mean, there was always going to be a risk of that because of the way the government charged and litigated the case against Mr. Samuels. As the government says, he was charged with possession with intent to distribute cocaine, and he was charged with participation in this conspiracy to distribute heroin. And that text, again, you know, I know the government said it was about coded message for drug transactions. It's unclear. It's just unclear which drug we're referring to, but it is within the period of the conspiracy.
Okay. Thank you.
And then I was going to talk really quickly about the Mr. Clark's testimony, just that I think the record is not as clear as the government characterizes that. And we disagree that that the judge's instruction would have cured that. I think the instruction was Mr. Samuels to lose, and it was a lapse in representation to have led the court to believe that the facts were not there to support it.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Schmidt.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McCarr.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's point apropos of the jury's acquitting people of various charges, I want to focus on Mr. Tucker for a moment. Where'd that heroin come from? There wasn't any evidence in the record where that heroin came from. There wasn't any evidence of him dealing with Jonathan Fields with that heroin. The photos that the government talked about, of what? They're ambiguous. Again, no audio, no cooperator testimony linking my client to any specific sales or any sales of heroin. So you have a case, I think a pristine case of transference. In terms of the government's argument and the sentencing, they say, well, it was presumptively correct. Well, the methodology isn't presumptively correct. The methodology should be reviewed de novo. And here, being there at the barbershop, doing what? There are no other sales in a record. The government points to Mr. Venable. Judge Mehta eschewed any reference to Venable's sales. He judged Mr. Tucker on what he thought, and I say incorrectly so, Mr. Tucker had sold in furtherance of a conspiracy.
What's your theory, Mr. LaCar? What's your theory for what Tucker was doing at the barbershop every day?
My theory is he's hanging around. He's got multiple sources of supply. Remember, Judge Walker, he did get a multiple conspiracy instruction. He's the only one in the case who got that. So he had multiple sources of supply. And this is important to note this as well, Your Honor. He's not up at Barnaby Place, or is it Barnaby Street? I can never get it straight in my own mind, but he's not up there at the retail location where a number of those who were charged and others who pled out were said to have been selling retail drugs. He's a hardscrabble drug dealer. I don't know where his sources are from. That's what Judge Mehta was struggling with as well with the text. Now, if I could, Judge Walker, I want to circle back to that dialogue you and I had about waiver. My first statement is I probably should not have used the word waiver. It's probably more of a forfeiture argument than a waiver, but it's the same effect in the end. Putting aside the legal niceties, I want to deal with this on a practical terms. This is the Court of Appeals. In general, we give respect to the institutional role of the district judge who's got the closer feel at sentencing. So I'm not asking you to be a social scientist. I'm not asking any of you to tolerate anything that Lonell Tucker did. I want to concede to you, he's a small-scale drug dealer. But in an age of overcrowding or dramatic over-sentencing, Judge Mehta saw this. And the government, I think subliminally, in not cross-appealing, recognized as well. this is a career offender guidelines. This court doesn't need to reach out for that where the parties didn't address it. It wasn't briefed and nobody addressed it until it came up here. Judge Mehta felt that the career offender guidelines themselves offended his sense of justice. And I tip my hat to him because they do. What is Lynell Tucker other than a hardscrabble small scale drug dealer? He's not a career offender. And I think the court should respect this these cases. I have no further observations.
All right. Thank you all for a very good argument. The case is submitted.